This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Economists and traders expect that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates this week for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis. Now, it's easy to notice that unemployment is at a 50-year low and to notice that mortgage rates are down. What the Fed does can be harder to connect with your day-to-day life, but it matters in ways that can be hard to see, but easy to feel. Economists are debating whether lowering interest rates will delay or hasten a recession. Why would the Fed lower the cost of borrowing now? How does that actually work? And what might it mean for you? Joining us here in studio is Gina Smilek, who covers the Federal Reserve and the economy for the New York Times. Gina, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio is Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That's a nonpartisan think tank focused on fiscal policy. Mark, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Gina, let's start with just some basic information. The Federal Reserve is kind of necessarily opaque in a way. If you've ever heard a statement from the chairman, it's one of those things that you kind of need, you know, translated. So let's just start from the beginning. What is the Federal Reserve?
Right. So the Federal Reserve is America's central bank. And essentially what they are tasked with is just keeping the economy operating at an even keel. And so the idea is they raise and lower interest rates as a way of achieving their two primary goals, which are maximum employment and stable inflation. They define stable inflation as just roughly around 2%. So enough to guard against harmful deflation, which can make it harder for the economy to keep growing because people hoard cash, and not so much that it really hurts consumers.
Now, we call the Federal Reserve a bank. It's not the kind of bank that's like a repository for the nation's money. That's more like the Treasury, right?
Right. So the Federal Reserve is what you might think of as sort of a bank's bank. And so what they do is they have these relationships with all of the different banks in the country. They help to oversee them. They manage sort of interbank markets, so the money that is held between banks overnight. And what they really do is they set interest rates, and by setting one of those interbank rates. And by setting interest rates, they kind of affect how much money supply there is in the economy. They affect how quick the economy can expand or how much it's going to slow down. Basically, they just kind of nudge around the edges to make sure that things don't get too hot during good times. And when the economy slows down, they come to the rescue.
And when you say interbank rates, you're talking about the rate that banks kind of lend money to one another?
Overnight. Yep, exactly. And so that has historically been the Fed's primary tool, although things are changing a little bit in a pretty wonky way right now. But I think the key message is that the way that they affect the economy is really via interest rates and money supply. They also, during the crisis, your listeners might be aware, did quite a unconventional policy that has now become more usual for central banks to do, which is that they bought and held Treasury securities and agency-backed mortgage-backed securities. And the idea behind that was just to give the economy a little bit of extra boost, because what they've traditionally done is really affected short-term interest rates, and they wanted to hit interest rates across what economists call the curve, so sort of into longer durations.
Mark Goldwine, this interest rate, what exactly are we talking about when we say the Fed will cut this interest rate? What is this rate?
Sure. So the Federal Reserve has sort of two rates that it is focused on, right? It's overnight rate, but also the rate that it actually pays on reserves. But the key is that when the Federal Reserve adjusts interest rates, it actually can trickle throughout the entire economy. So if the Federal Reserve cuts by a quarter, that might mean a quarter cut in mortgage rates, a similar size cut in credit card rates, car loans, business loans, even the amount of money that you get on your bank deposits.
So it has this ripple effect, but in a direct sense, if the Federal Reserve says, we're going to cut this interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point, what is that actually directly cutting the interest rate on?
Right. So the two major things that they're doing is they are a depository for other banks. And so they actually pay an interest rate on the cash that they are holding for those banks. That's the key one that they're playing with right now. But at the same time, they're also cutting the rate with which they're lending to other banks, especially overnight.
What does it mean when a rate goes up or goes down, typically speaking?
Yeah. So when the Federal Reserve raises rates, and so therefore loans are more expensive and savings is more valuable, what we'd expect to see is people saving more and borrowing less, right? And during inflationary times, that can be helpful because it can stop the economy from overheating. When the Fed cuts rates, we'd expect the reverse. We expect that people will borrow more and save less and thus spend more throughout the economy.
So I just want to make sure we're clear, Mark. If the Federal Reserve raises rates, then, you know, the people who give out home mortgages or car loans might raise their rates too. What's their rationale for following the Federal Reserve? Why not go in the opposite direction?
Well, remember, the Federal Reserve is the bank's bank, right? And so the entire financial system is linked, and there's only limited arbitrage opportunities. So if the Federal Reserve is offering a more generous rate and other banks are cutting, there's not going to be any room for them to make money or them to have profit.
I'm sorry, arbitrage?
Yeah, thanks. So there always are differences throughout the economy in various prices and signals. And when you see a major difference, there's sort of profit opportunities where you can close that gap through trades. That only works to a limited degree, and it can't really work if you're moving in the opposite direction of the major bank of the country.
We're speaking to Mark Goldwein of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and Gina Smilek of the New York Times. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well, 1A@WAMU.org. Gina, who runs the Federal Reserve? Who's in charge?
So the Federal Reserve is actually an independent body, and so it's a little bit of a complicated system. So I'll just walk you through sort of the basics. But essentially, there is a Board of Governors in Washington, and there are seven members on the Board of Governors, although they aren't all full right now. But the President of the United States gets to nominate those governors, and then Congress confirms them. Once they've gotten those jobs, they can only be removed for cause, which basically means malfeasance. They can only be removed if they actually do something wrong. So those guys sit in Washington, and they're sort of, you know, the stalwarts of the committee is a good way to think of them. They have a constant vote on monetary policy, and from the governors, you get your vice chair and your chairman, who is the most important member and probably the most recognizable member of the Fed. Currently, that's Jay Powell. Then you've got 12 members who sit around the table at every interest rate decision but don't get to vote on every one. Those guys are presidents from the regional banks, and they are actually selected by representatives at the regional bank.
So these are like if we see Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis or Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, that's the 12.
Precisely, exactly. And four of those guys get to vote at any given time. They cycle in and out on a rotating basis. And so you've got this combination of the governors in Washington and the regional banks who set policy at every meeting, but everybody is present in the discussion. And if you talk to folks who actually sit on the committee, they often will tell you that it doesn't really matter who has a vote at any given meeting. What really matters is that everyone is there and contributing. Although I have to add that people do dissent against decisions once in a while, though they will occasionally vote no. And at those moments, it can matter who is voting.
So you've got these seven main members at the top. You've got four rotating in and out, so 11 people kind of voting at any given time. So there's kind of a way to break ties. What is the thought process behind, say, cutting interest rates? I mean, the last time the Fed cut interest rates was in 2008 during the recession. If they cut interest rates now, and again, this is what many are expecting, but the Fed has not announced this yet. So just to be clear, we're just going on what analysts are suggesting. What might some of the rationale be for cutting interest rates now?
Precautionary. This is entirely a precautionary move. And so what people may be aware of is that the economy is actually doing decently well right now. You know, growth has looked pretty solid. Consumer spending is still strong. A lot of different metrics of labor market strength are really in the green. I think what the Fed is most focused on, though, is that there are a lot of uncertainties on the outlook. Those include the tariffs that the Trump administration has put in effect. Those seem to be denting business confidence. And then also a big global slowdown. We're seeing manufacturers around the world really pull back, and the Fed wants to get ahead of those concerns.
That's some of what the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell mentioned in testimony before Congress this month. He explained why the Fed might cut interest rates. Here is part of what Chairman Powell said.
At our January, March, and May meetings, we stated that we would be patient as we determined what future adjustments to the federal funds rate might be appropriate to support our goals of maximum employment and price stability. Since then, based on incoming data and other developments, it appears that uncertainties around trade tensions and concerns about the strength of the global economy continue to weigh on the U.S. economic outlook.
That's Fed Chairman Jerome Powell speaking before Congress earlier this month. Mark?
So I think an important piece there is the Fed's dual mandate, right? So they can afford to be precautionary because right now they're doing excellent on their goal of stable prices. In fact, they haven't even been able to hit their inflation target of 2%. So that's really what allows the Fed the wiggle room to feel like they can be precautionary in order to combat a potential recession.
Quick question before we pause. Mick commented on our Facebook page, "This is an atrocious monetary policy. The interest rate should be triple what it is now. If we cut now, what are we going to do when the bubble bursts?" Gina, what is this concern in terms of what the interest rate should be? Triple what it is now?
So he's right in that historically, interest rates have been much higher than they are right now. Back in 2007, when we started cutting, rates were at 5.25%. They're currently at 2.25 to 2.5%. So they are much lower. But that is because the economy has changed fundamentally in that period. What we've seen is a much lower run rate of growth, really different demographics, and slower productivity. And between all of those factors, rates have just come down a lot. The rate that the economy can sustain while still growing, much lower than it was in the past.
Much more to discuss as we continue our conversation with Gina Smilek of the New York Times and Mark Goldwein of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the Fed and that pesky interest rate that everyone seems to be interested in. Mark, before we move too far forward, that clip we played from Chairman Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve, he mentioned trade tensions and the strength of the global economy. Could you expand a little bit more on the link between interest rates in the U.S. and the economy around the world? What's the connection?
Right. So the link actually works in the other direction, which is what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is keep the United States economy stable. But the United States economy isn't an island, right? We trade with other countries. We have financial flows with other countries. And so if the rest of the globe is weak, that could come back and make the U.S. weak. And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve is trying to prevent.
So how does the interest rate help insulate us from that?
It doesn't insulate us per se, but what a lower interest rate does is it can help to keep spending and borrowing and even investing moving at a time that people might otherwise be more precautionary and want to save their money in case of sort of global turmoil.
So it makes the U.S. look like a good place to do business, even though the rest of the world might be kind of shaky.
There's a bit of that. There's a bit of that through exchange rates. But the bigger effect is really just that it gets Americans to continue to spend in America and not to be as affected by what's going on around the world.
Gina, you mentioned that one of the goals of the Fed has to do with the job market and employment. Talk about what that goal actually means when we say things like full employment. I mean, what exactly is the Fed aiming for? Or is that kind of a moving target?
Yeah, so this is a fun question at this specific moment because it has just changed dramatically over the last year. So historically, the Fed thought that under a certain level of unemployment, wages would start rising and that would lead companies to eventually lift prices. And so the idea was a low enough unemployment rate would eventually drive higher inflation. And so the Fed really used to understand full employment as sort of this trade-off, this Goldilocks level at which the unemployment rate wasn't so low that it pushed inflation way too high. But this time around, unemployment has fallen really, really low to basically its lowest level in 50 years, and inflation is kind of nowhere to be found. And so the takeaway from this is that full employment, maximum employment, as the Fed previously understood it, doesn't seem to be playing out anymore. And so now maximum employment has become much more of a moving target and something that they're allowed to sort of play around with in a way that I don't think we previously saw.
Well, you have more employment, but middle class wages haven't really moved. So the prospect of people being able to spend more I don't know what the interest rate can do to influence that. That's kind of businesses deciding what they want to pay people.
So the idea is that by setting interest rates at a level that's permissive of growth, so something that encourages investment from businesses and from households, you're going to allow for the economy as a whole to grow a little bit faster. That's going to lead to more hiring. And as the unemployment rate drops steadily lower, that'll push wages up. It's worth noting that wages have increased a little bit. They just haven't sort of galloped away the way you would expect late in a cycle. And so the Fed is really sort of waiting for that shoe to drop, I think.
Mark, I'd like to get your reaction to another clip from Jerome Powell. He held a press conference in May to talk about something that you mentioned earlier, Gina, which was concern about low inflation, which, as you said, has yet to reach that kind of 2% target that was adopted back in 2012. Here's part of what Chairman Powell said back in May.
We say in our statement of longer-run goals and monetary policy strategy that the committee would be concerned if inflation were running persistently above or below 2%. If we did see a persistent inflation running persistently below, then that is something the committee would be concerned about and something that we would take into account in setting policy.
That was Chairman Powell speaking back in May. Mark, why would he be concerned about inflation being too low, and what kind of policy would be the reaction to that?
So if inflation is literally zero or negative, you can have really bad implications to the economy. But when he says, when Chairman Powell says he's concerned about low inflation, it's not the low inflation per se, you know, 1.5%. It's the fact that it's a signal that the Fed basically could be doing more to boost employment. Because as Gina mentioned, we would expect to see higher inflation if we were at maximum employment. And so it's more a signal of the Federal Reserve not doing everything it can be doing on the employment side than the danger of inflation itself.
Isn't low inflation a good thing? Doesn't that mean that I don't have to pay that much more for milk or eggs or gas or furniture or a house or a car?
Absolutely. That's why I said within reason, it's not the low inflation itself that's the danger. It's what the low inflation tells us about the employment side of the equation.
Gina?
It also is, I'm going to push back a little bit. So it's also just a little bit the low inflation itself in the sense that the Fed is really worried about becoming Japan. And so what we've seen happen in Japan is that inflation sunk a little bit low and it stayed a little bit low for a really long time. Businesses and consumers started consistently expecting lower inflation. And now the Bank of Japan just cannot get inflation back up. And that ends up being sort of this disinflationary spiral where you just, it keeps getting lower and lower and you get stuck in the mud and the Fed does not want to get into that kind of a position.
Oh, by the way, Gina, you mentioned the Bank of Japan. Does every nation have an equivalent of the Federal Reserve with the same kinds of levers to pull?
So most developed nations do. It's worth noting that some countries have a slightly different system. So China is a good one that I think people are probably very aware of right now because President Trump talks about them a lot. But in China, for example, the central bank is much more closely integrated with the overall government. And so they don't have the sort of operational independence that the Fed enjoys, which most research suggests over time leads to worse outcomes because it leads to more short-term thinking.
Mark?
And also remember, some countries actually share central banks. So for example, the entire EU essentially shares, or most everyone under the euro shares a single central bank.
European Central Bank.
Exactly. And I also want to agree with that point. I think there is this risk of low inflation in the Japan case. And a piece of it is that the lower inflation is, actually the less room the Federal Reserve has to cut interest rates, because the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates based on the nominal interest rate. So if inflation is running only 1%, that means that they only have very little to cut between their real interest rate and zero.
We'll get to some of your questions after a quick break. Stay close.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Every day, innovative companies are reinventing the way business happens. But none of that is possible without the right people. People who get packages to over 150 million delivery points affordably and on time with the latest technology and expertise. Who can help you deliver the future of commerce? The United States Postal Service. See why they deliver more e-commerce packages to homes than anyone in the country at usps.com/future.
Going on a big group trip always sounds good in theory, but it can get tricky when you get there and have totally different expectations. Check out NPR Life Kit's new guide on navigating group travel, or subscribe to Life Kit, all guides, for all our episodes, all in one place.
We're discussing what the Federal Reserve's expected interest rate cut might mean for you. Let's get to some more of your questions. Linda wrote on our Facebook page, "My credit card interest isn't going in that direction. I'm a great investor. Where's the trickle down from any of this?" Gina?
So credit cards are a funny one because they don't always, if you chart them against the Fed funds rate, they don't always chart that directly because there are a lot of other things that affect credit card rates. I think if you want to see where the Fed's rates are having a direct effect, you can look pretty closely at mortgages. So mortgages have really moved down this year just on the very fact that the Fed is so clearly signaling that it's going to cut rates. So just the idea that this is coming has made buying a house a little bit cheaper.
Barbara tweeted, "My concern with the Fed lowering rates as much as they have is where will they go if a recession hits? 0%. It's the lack of keeping a safety net that worries me." Mark, what about that? The concern about where it goes if there is a recession?
I think this is a very valid concern. When we entered the Great Recession, we had, I forget, interest rates 5.5% or something like that. And by the way, on the fiscal side, we had very low debt to GDP. And so we were able to cut rates a lot and we were able to borrow a lot on the fiscal side. If we hit a recession this time, we won't have as much room on either. And I think it's a very valid concern. I've heard keeping interest rates high sort of akin to training at high altitudes, right? You make yourself a little bit worse in the training process, but you're much better prepared for the real game. And I think there's something to that.
Gina?
The Fed would probably disagree wholeheartedly to what Mark just said. So their research finds, and they seem to genuinely believe, that when you are in a situation where you have very low interest rates, what makes the most sense is to get moving early and sort of try and inoculate the economy against a downturn, because that leads to lower unemployment spikes during the recession and makes a recession easier to climb out of. And so this idea is, counterintuitively, when interest rates are low, it just ups the ante on getting moving early if you see any signs of trouble.
So the Fed would argue, Gina, that the best way, at least at this point, to deal with a potential recession would not be to have the interest rates higher before the recession. It's to keep the interest rates lower before the recession with enough room to go yet lower if necessary.
So basically the idea is, if you tried to put interest rates higher just to give yourself more ammunition come the recession, you would risk creating the recession. So if we had interest rates at 5.25% today, it's quite likely that the economy would not be able to handle that. So the economic growth would slow, you know, things would look pretty bad.
And borrowing would get more expensive, people would freak out.
Yeah. Precisely. And we could actually create a recession. This is what the Fed, I think, would tell you. The idea is, we're stuck in a world where we can't have especially high interest rates. In that universe, it makes more sense to be precautionary rather than trying to save up your ammunition for the downturn.
Do we have any good examples, Mark or Gina, of where the Fed just got it wrong, where they thought that they were moving in the right direction and then the economy just got smacked as a direct result of that decision? Can we point to when the Fed has done it wrong?
Yes. Yeah, I think we can definitely do that. So I think there have been several instances throughout the course of Fed history where they have been blamed, rightly or wrongly, for precipitating a recession. People will often point to the 2007 to 2009 cycle, actually, both in the sense that they left rates low too long, then they took them up too quickly just before the recession. That's one idea. Also, I think people will look at the early 2000s recession as sort of a similar example. It's hard to know these things for sure, though, just because you don't have the counterfactual and you don't know what would have happened if the Fed hadn't been around.
Mark, I mean, I'll also add, I think some people are arguing now, including the President of the United States, that the Fed has been getting it wrong, that they raised rates too much over the last 2.5 years.
One listener tweeted, "Interest rates really only affect the ability of large businesses to borrow money. Lending is not a problem for businesses right now, though. Is this just going to wind up with the Fed shooting their shot way before it can have a useful anti-recessionary effect?" Too soon, Jenna? Or Gina?
That's actually, I think, a really interesting point and a real concern, is this idea that, you know, moving down a little bit right now might not matter that much because the economy is already chugging along pretty nicely. Credit conditions look okay, et cetera, et cetera. I think the arguments against that would be that before the Fed signaled back in June that they were going to cut interest rates, financial conditions were tightening. So it did look like we might be headed down a road where it was possible it was going to get a lot harder to borrow and lend. And so that if what they're doing now is really sort of following through on that promise they made a few months ago that did help to sort of avert a worse outcome, then you could see it as something that actually is good for credit creation.
Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for the New York Times. Gina, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Goldwein, Senior VP and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Orion Donovan Smith. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.